You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Everyone, the episode you're about to listen to is made possible by our producer level patrons, Sarah Sawatchka Dalton, Anne Marie Piccioni, and Teresa Rogers. We appreciate you so much, as well as all of our other patrons who help make the Art History Babes possible. If you would like to find out how to become a patron, head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes. For as low as $1 a month, you can gain access to an entire backlog of exclusive episodes. We produce one exclusive episode every month for our patrons. And for the month of March, we're going to be doing a special Patreon-only Q&A episode. All four of us, me, Nat, Ginny, and Jen, will be answering your questions. So if you have any questions for us at all involving art history, school, the podcast, content creation, travel, personal life, whatever, we are here to answer them. So how it's going to work is every question submitted to us from now until March 15th on Patreon will be answered in the March Patreon Q&A episode. So in order to participate, you must be a patron. Luckily, it's very easy to get started. And yeah, from now until March 15th, any question we get, it is going to be answered on that Q&A episode. Also, make sure you check out artandobject.com. We recently began partnering with them. It is a fantastic resource for art and art history. They have some really great articles, really great information, both involving art history and what's going on now in the contemporary art world. They also post podcasts and other art-related content. So check out artandobject.com. And that's all I got. Enjoy the show.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Jen.
I'm Ginny.
I'm Natalie.
And we are the art history babes.
What happened?
Ginny just got very confused during our intro.
I know. I think that we might have done some kind of different order or something.
Yeah.
It just like blew her
I mind. Think we're all a little hazy given
and we're
the
drinking...
events that went down last night.
We're still drinking though, and we're drinking a hazy IPA. It's called the Hazy Little Thing from Sierra Nevada. It's pretty good. It's family owned, operated, and argued over. Did you see that?
Oh, that's cute.
That's really
that's cute. Yeah, and we're here, and we have a guest. We have a friend, a pal. Our buddy Mariah is here.
Yay!
Hey, Mariah.
Hi.
Mariah was in our program in grad school, and she is here to talk about something that she loves dearly.
Maps.
Maps.
In all of their forms and facets.
Yes. But before we get into all that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Mariah? What's your deal?
My deal?
What's your birthstone? Everyone wants to know.
Ooh, turquoise.
Ooh.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a really good one.
Turquoise. I am a Sagittarius.
Nice.
Early December birthday.
Oh, Saggy.
If that helps frame anything I'm about to say.
That's great.
My people.
That's great. We love a Sagittarius.
Astrological context is great.
It never hurts, to be sure.
We're all over the place in the podcast. We've got a Scorpio. We've got a Libra, a Capricorn, and a Virgo.
Ooh, yeah. Just covering the whole.
And the Sagittarius.
Yeah.
We're all in a row because Virgo is followed by Libra, is followed by Scorpio, is followed by Sagittarius, is followed by Capricorn.
Yep.
That's true. Oh. So we have like one half of the year just straight through.
That's wild.
Yeah.
We don't mess around with those Aries, Taurus,
no,
Gemini, none of that. Leo people.
None of that. No, we're fall winter people.
Yeah, no spring summer's here.
I didn't even mention Pisces because...
Ooh,
just kidding. Shade. No, I don't know. I've had
jokes.
I've had some weird experiences with Pisces people. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. I want
jury's still out on Pisces.
If you're a Pisces and this is really upsetting to hear, just, you know, reach out. Tell me that I'm wrong.
Yeah,
there are no words.
Making enemies.
Coming in strong. Making enemies for no reason.
Oh my God. So, what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
I tell the youth of America how to appreciate art.
There we go.
Mm-hmm. A modern day hero.
Thanks.
I'm not sure they think that, but maybe they do.
They will someday.
Someday.
They don't
someday.
Right now.
They'll appreciate it.
Yeah, I do that. So it's about the extent of it.
Is it just art appreciation right now, or is there any other fun classes on the horizon or that you have taught that you really enjoy?
Pretty much it. I teach another class called Monuments of World Art, which is a non-Western survey course, which cool. is a joy. I always like exposing people to new things and new
Definitely.
Ideas that
right.
actually reflect the culture.
I just like the title of that class. Monuments. I don't know. It just feels...
It's true. It's fun.
Legal.
Monuments is just a great word because it just sounds so fucking important. My
Definitely.
Thesis title had monument in the name.
Oh,
I
yeah,
just remember
it did.
That.
It did.
Monument and magic... And then some other shit.
It's okay. I don't remember my thesis title. I know it's really long.
Yeah.
So is mine.
How you do it is like you have a couple like flashy, sexy words, and then yeah. you have a colon.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of shit.
And
after
then the
that.
Descriptors.
Oh, yeah. it is.
What it actually is.
There is 100% just like a very clear layout of how you come up with a
yes.
academic thesis
yeah,
title.
Yeah, we have like a whole class on it.
They
it
have
really
like the same cadence, they just
do.
Have the same flow.
Yeah. Do you all remember the first part before the colon for yours?
Oh, mine.
I could look it up.
Mine was
yarn bombing, radical fiber art. And Bertie Sanders, I think. And then something about socialism and craftivism.
Yeah,
and
mine was Enrique Chagoya's Cannibals, colon, the unknowable savage. And then I forget what was after that. But it was long.
But the first part's the, like...
That's a right. snappy part.
And it was really flashy because it was like, oh, cannibals. Mm-hmm. So
maybe yeah. we'll do a YouTube video on how to write an academic title for an academic paper.
Alliteration never
oh,
works.
No. It's key.
It's my go-to. Look at all my papers from grad school. They all do it. Mm-hmm. All of them.
It I works. Think. It
Most
works.
Most of them.
No, you're right, because monuments and magic. Mm-hmm. Ooh. I like it. We're good at what we do.
So we were just watching our forever president, Barack Obama.
My president.
Telling the youth of America to vote. That was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And even though I don't know when this episode's coming out, but I hope you voted. I just want to say
yeah.
that.
Yeah. I hope you did.
Do it. It's your civic duty.
Yeah, right.
It's if you didn't vote, we're mad at you. We're real mad.
Do not reach out.
Do not. And I'm sure we have listeners from outside of the U.S.
Oh, yeah. So, we have lots of listeners from
you
outside
know,
the U.S.
Looking from the outside, I'm sure that the U.S. looks like a real shit show to everyone in the world right now. And you are right. So hopefully some kind of change ushers in through this midterm election.
Yeah.
So.
Let's put that out into the universe. Let's
yeah.
just hope good things for the
I'm
coming weeks.
I'm really hoping. Yeah.
Yeah. Putting it out there. Yeah, and let's all get out there and vote, and it's going to be good. It's going to be good, you guys. It has to be
it
good.
It has to be good. It can't get worse.
Can it?
I you know what? I
Don't
immediately
that.
Rescind
yeah.
that plot.
Right back in.
Yeah, I didn't just say that.
And she didn't.
No, that didn't happen. Do we want to talk about maps? Are we ready to talk about maps?
Let's get into it.
Maps!
So the question for today, are maps real? Because I'm looking at a lot of maps.
Oh,
and
great question.
I know it sounds absurd, but
no, it's good.
It's a good jumping off point. I mean,
they are.
That reminded me of.
Establish that.
That reminded me of Broad City, the witch episode, when Abby is like, witches aren't real, you guys. And Bever's like, what do you think's going on here? Do you think this is all just literal stuff?
Can we watch that after?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
No, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that all these maps are hilariously different.
Stuff's pretty murky.
And we don't really know even if we have it down today, I would say that maybe we don't. So,
well, I think, and we'll get into this, I think, because this episode is definitely going to lean philosophical pretty quick. But does the concept of trying to map out something that you can only really experience a certain way, but map it in an objective way, is just difficult and flawed to
begin
with.
Making a 3D thing 2D.
Yeah.
Just inherently makes it not correct.
Exactly.
It's an uphill battle.
In the nature of the object.
Yeah.
And scale, too.
So before we get into all that and start working through some of these heavy questions concerning maps, Mariah, do you want to tell us a little bit about maybe one, what drew you to maps, and two, what your thesis research was about?
Sure. I have liked maps as long as I can remember. Truly. As long as I can remember. It's one of like the stories that my dad likes to tell people when we go places. Just like my constant excitement over atlases, being near them, having them, touching them, knowing where to go. Geography has always been my jam. And so that part of it has been like a through line of my life. And then I didn't think about it necessarily like in an art historical context. I mean, I knew people drew them and that they were an art object. But one of my thesis advisors before she became my advisor was like, maps are in right now. Have you thought about that? Just like as an offhanded thing. And I was like, ooh, that speaks to me.
Yeah.
That feels authentic. Let's look into this. And that's how that whole doing it in grad school thing
definitely
happened, but I've always liked them.
It makes sense that maps are very in right now because post-colonial theory is very in right now. And I feel like attacking a map from a post-colonial lens is a very...
Oh, yeah. It's hot right now.
Yeah, it's a that's just a good, straightforward way to do that, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was a really fascinating topic because I would say probably 90% of my research came from books published in the past 5 years.
Nice.
So it's very much happening now.
I'm
like,
awesome.
What are people thinking? What does it mean? Most writing about maps has been done, obviously, in the geography context and sort of just general history. So like looking at them as an art object has been a really new direction for people, which was very exciting for me, too. It's like, oh, this is nice. It's easy to be like, oh, is my thesis going to be unique? Yes, because it's literally being done right now. Though it was also very stressful because I was in constant worry that they were going to publish a book.
Oh, yeah.
Like just with things I wanted, saying what I'm saying.
That's
sort of
very
thing.
Much how I felt about my thesis, too. Like everyone was writing about the thing or starting to get on board with this like craft and craft activism. And my thesis advisor wanted me to publish and stuff. But if I'm being completely honest, I don't know that I was saying that much that other people weren't also saying. Like it came from me, but I think similarly, my thesis topic was something that a lot of people were giving a lot of attention all at one time. Mm-hmm. And so you have this weird like, oh, like a lot of people are coming to these same realizations, you know?
No, I was thinking about you recently because there's been a whole like slew of books coming out about women's anger and women's rage that were like just freakishly timed on like the moment.
Yeah, I just read about this.
Like, and so I'm like, oh, like how there's 5 or 6 people writing a book on the same topic that are all coming from their own places,
exactly.
but are all very of the moment because like you were doing your work and then the women's march happened and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So I was just, like, lucky.
It happened super serendipitously, but obviously I wasn't the only person making those connections with this super high profile thing that was going on, you know? So yeah, I'd imagine with this, like we said, being hot right now, post-colonial theory, looking at maps, thinking about what maps mean, people who are working in that are going to run into a lot of the same questions. Yeah.
It is funny because now that my thesis, I like tried because it's too much to do in a master's thesis. Didn't talk that much about post-colonial theory just because it's being talked about in so many ways with people who are so much more qualified than I am at the present moment to like pull out all of the theory. So I focused mine on knowledge and ignorance and the unknown. Like I looked at maps in terms of how do you show the bottom of the world before you actually knew it was there, which touches on post-colonial.
Exactly.
Things, for sure.
I was going to say your whole theoretical arc ties into post-colonial theory, though. Like even if you didn't specifically use post-colonial research, the theoretical underlying stuff from your research is very applicable to that approach to things. Yeah, do you want to say maybe a little bit more about like kind of what your whole thesis thing was?
My thesis was looking at this newfangled theory called agnotology, which is the study of culturally induced ignorance, and how that applies to the art world and how it applies to maps in particular.
That's dope.
And I looked at one map, just one, made by a Dutch guy in 1608, and how he represented what was commonly referred to as the Terra Incognita, or unknown land, which is Antarctica before they knew what was there. And also most of the Pacific Islands, Africa. I mean, the Terra Incognita shifted forms throughout its history, but this is right before they actually knew what was at the bottom. So the sort of last moment before you couldn't just make up stuff anymore.
Can you say that word for us again? Mm-hmm. The culturally induced ignorance?
Agnotology.
Agnotology.
That's a good word.
It's made keeping up, that one.
It's made up by a guy at Stanford.
Oh, of course.
Named Robert Proctor. And it refers mostly in reference to scientific things, like the guy who made up the term. His research is actually on smoking and how propaganda. So it's not been used in an art historical context really at all. And so it's very much like, how do we... There's a few different kinds of ignorance. And so that's sort of like a whole chunk of my thesis and a whole chunk of what this idea is. Like, it's not always a bad thing. Like when you're a baby, you don't know lots of things. Mm-hmm. And that's a form of ignorance. And scientific discovery, like the fact that you don't know things, spurs you on and spurs you into looking at what's over there. And by nature of looking at one thing, it means you're not looking at something else. That's its own form of ignorance. And then there's the shady kind, you know, like, I'm going to trick you. I'm going to purposefully gaslight you. I mean, it's a very relevant topic of the now, too, in terms of how do we use ignorance as a culture to push forward ideas and that sort of thing.
Definitely. That reminds me of this comic by Poorly Drawn Lines, which is a fantastic account that you should check out if you haven't, the other day. And it was just these two mice. One was like, "You're wrong." And the mouse was like, "I'm not wrong. I just didn't know that I wasn't right." And I loved that. I was like, that is real, though. I think that's a different, more nuanced form of ignorance. You know, there are different layers to that concept. And I just thought that that was really smart. And a different form of, there's a difference between doing something wrongfully and then just not knowing, and how those different approaches to just knowing information like can play out, you know what I mean? And what they say about intention, and there's so much to it.
No, and I thought a lot about privacy and celebrity image and how they like constructed it. I didn't pull it into my thesis, but I'm not even that guilty, but just a guilty pleasure is celebrity gossip and all of that, and just like how do celebrities construct their own image. And that's a lot of purposeful ignorance. Beyonce doesn't let you see into her life in any meaningful way.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's constructing this play between what you get to know and what you don't know. And so she's using purposefully culturally induced ignorance to frame her own image.
Yeah.
For her own benefit. She's perfectly entitled to do that. So it's not always nefarious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not bad. Like, it's just,
you know, keeping war secrets and those sorts of things or a version of it, but that's not always that bad.
Yeah, because that's also a complicated thing. I don't know how to be like a world leader during wartime. Like, obviously, you think that being transparent is super important, but war is complicated. Mm-hmm. I don't know that all people should know everything all the time, you know? I don't know. It's a complicated thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I took that complicated thing and just plopped it on a map.
Yeah.
Wow. I really loved your thesis presentation, and I thought that you were just great. And this idea that the parts of the world that we don't know just don't exist, right? Like, so you know something's there, but you don't know what. So it just becomes like a purposefully ignored thing. I feel like we do that a lot with knowledge in general. Mm-hmm. Just like, that sounds hard and I don't know enough about that, so I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist.
And there's something about that too where, it can be nefarious, but it could also just be overwhelming.
Yeah.
If you try to take on understanding a whole part of the world that you don't even know if it really exists, that's a lot, you know? Like,
no, this has framed European map culture for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, before, in the Greek, Roman, medieval times, they were like, we don't know what's down there, so we're just gonna make this squiggly blob.
Monsters.
monsters. Like, I don't know, it can't be good. For whatever reason, a theory started in Greek eras and then continued through Roman writings of the equator was like this burning wall of heat the ocean was boiling and that you couldn't go through it. And so that's a coping mechanism for like the world is just too big. I don't know what's down there.
And it's also, I don't know, like a Truman Show type of situation where you want to just keep your people safe and like in one place. So you're, there's monsters and a fiery wall.
It's bad.
And like it's just you don't want to go there. You don't want to do it. And so I think, there's like a fear-inducing aspect to it as well as a means of trying to probably keep people safe or encourage them to, you know, stay where they are.
Yeah. That reminds me, too, of when some of us here had a seminar on the body in ancient Greek art, and we talked a lot about monsters and read a lot about monster theory, kind of in general, but, you know, with the Greeks, because they would have monsters as a way of acting like border patrol almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you'd read or hear stories from Greek mythology, usually bad shit happened to people when they were away from the polis, from like the city state, which, you know, was safe and controlled and protected. And then once you cross that border, you could come upon a cyclops.
Yeah. Just think of like the Odyssey.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
That was just Mediterranean.
So many monsters.
Yeah, exactly. The lesson there was stay home and it'll all be good and you're not going to come across these big meanies that want to eat you.
Yeah. It's like M. Night Shyamalan's The Village.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
That love movie. That movie.
Jesus.
But yeah, these monsters that kind of kept this community in one little place so they didn't experience the outside world. Yeah.
So I don't mean to sound silly, but do we know of the first map? When did we as humans start to conceive the world as this whole place that we want a visual representation of where things are?
They're doing it everywhere for a long time, but in terms of the Western world, in quote marks, Babylon, there's a stone tablet that has a sort of generally circular representation of the world with little like, here's this place, here's this place, here's this place, you know, a very limited conception, but a general
directions.
Yeah, like shapes. A general visual layout of where everything is. And it continued, or there's writings of them, at least not every map has survived, but there's been pretty generally a consistent, like people are trying to represent the world in some way around them for a very, very long time. I mean, they're doing it in other parts of the world too. The one that comes to mind to me is like an Australian Aboriginal art, like their entire artistic practice is representing the world around them. Not on like a global scale, but around them in some facet. Mm-hmm. There's these cool stick maps from the Marshall Islands and like the Pacific of mapping the waves and mapping the ocean so that you can get around when you live on a desert atoll. You just need to go to other places to find resources. So there's all kinds of different things that might not be familiar to our eyes, but people have been trying to be like, where am I? Where's my friend's house? Where's the food? Where's the water?
Yeah, definitely.
For a really long time, which it's a great question to think about. Like, who decided one day, I think I'm gonna draw this?
Mm-hmm.
Someone who kept getting lost.
Yeah, it was like, here's how you get over here.
My ancestors.
Nat is not gifted in
I'm straight directionally challenged. I have no idea what is around me. Well, and it's funny too, I was thinking about this and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but just this idea that most of us are so used to having GPS technology nowadays that a lot of people don't even know how to read a map. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember being like a teenager when I first got a car and just having the AAA maps that I could look at, and that's how I would
MapQuest.
I didn't
you print out your MapQuest,
right? And MapQuest was wrong like a lot of the time.
I was having, this was like a year ago, but conversation with Alan Templeton about how having GPS, having Google Maps on our phones, it's really destroying our abilities to retain how to get places, which is 100% true. There were times living in Davis, California, which is not a big town.
It's a grid.
It's
like
a grid. It's a flat
navigated streets.
It's a flat grid. It's small. I lived there for 2 years, and there were times I still used like Google Maps to get places, which is absurd. Like, that's an absurd thing because we're just so reliant on that that we're not using our brains to map shit out anymore. We're just relying on our phone to map
Can
it out
I
for us.
Can I play devil's advocate, though, and say that maybe that is allowing us to retain information about other things that now we don't need to worry about retaining?
I think that's totally... That's totally a fair point to make, but I also think that that concept spans out, because actually we had a conversation about this a while back, how like technology and phones for like the younger generations, we don't have a strong long-term memory capacity because we just can always get the information, so we don't have to
like
process process information to that deep learning space, because we always know we can just get it, whereas previous generations were more capable of sending the information through that deep learning long-term memory space. While I think just from like a futuristic standpoint, that's a totally fair assessment. There's also this idea like, but how are we neglecting our long-term, like are we not exercising our long-term memory?
What does it mean to outsource your memory to an item? It's nice, but what does it do to your actual brain?
That's such a good way to think of it, outsourcing our memory.
Like
that should be the title of a something.
Of a book, probably.
Ted Radio Hour episode. You know, dystopian future where we can't remember shit.
Because we're like, where did my...
Oh my goodness. I mean, it connects to, if you want to think about other futuristic dystopian stuff, Elon Musk had his whole thing on whatchamacallit's podcast.
Joe Rogan's
podcast, where he was talking about how next step is basically implanting little computers like our cell phones in our brains, because we're so attached to them, we're already like cyborgs. And like,
might as well just make it final.
Yeah.
Just acknowledge the relationship.
And that is legitimately outsourcing your memory to technology.
Some Black Mirror shit.
Yeah.
I don't like that at all.
Have you guys seen that episode of Black Mirror?
I really just
alarming.
You know, I was really late to the Black Mirror game, and I've watched the first season. And then I was like, I'm good. Like, I just
I watched this too much. I haven't yet.
I can't handle this.
The season got really dark. I don't know.
I watched one episode and I was done. I couldn't go.
The pig fucker episode.
I couldn't. I was like,
that's
nope.
Tricky.
That was grotesque.
Too much for me. I can't handle this.
I'm sorry. Did you say pig fucker?
I mean, that's what
happened. Spoiler.
Yeah.
You haven't seen that one, Jen?
The Prime Minister.
Isn't that the first episode?
Yeah, that's the first
the
episode.
UK, someone, some like loose relation of the royal family is kidnapped, and she will only be released if the Prime Minister fucks a pig on live television.
Okay, I'm wrong. I watched the newest season that came out with my friend who was like, I'm watching Black Mirror. Do you want to watch it? That's all I saw.
And you can do that because they're individual.
Right, yeah, exactly.
That's a nice thing. It's always there.
Right. And so, no, I am not familiar with the pig fucker episode, and I kind of don't want to know about it.
Yeah, that was the first one for me, and that was far too much for me. I couldn't, like, I love weird, like trippy shit that makes you think, but my sensitivities couldn't handle it.
There are other ones I've watched. I haven't ever watched it in a steady stream of like episode, but I've watched some other ones that I enjoyed and appreciated a lot more than the pig fucker one.
Yeah. It was an interesting choice to start out with.
Yeah.
They put all the cards out there right away.
Right.
Yeah.
This is who we
are. They didn't tell you for that. Yeah. Like if something gets awry. Like,
yeah.
Whoa.
Anyway,
so maps.
Yeah, let's get back to maps.
Actually, maybe let's take a quick break.
Okay, yeah, let's take a break.
A little. Let's.
That's a good idea.
A message from our sponsors.
Boop.
We have returned from our
snack break,
sponsorship break. Thank you, sponsors. We're here with our pal Mariah, fellow art history babe, talking about maps. Where did we leave off? What were we talking about?
We were talking about Black Mirror, which was interesting. And
as one does.
An interesting tangent. Yeah, so I want to know a little bit more, Mariah, about your thesis and just what's up with this map made by this Dutch guy?
Good question. I looked very closely at one particular map that had a ton of decoration on it. And the space I looked at, like I'd sort of mentioned before, was how did he represent the bottom of the world? So he called it the Terra Incognita. So just literally said, I don't know what's down here. And then covered it with things. And so his particular version of things were diagrams of how he made the map, and then portraits of other explorers, and then tiny maps of their routes around the world.
Oh.
Which is the only map. This is a great time to say, if somebody finds another example of something like this, let me know.
Oh, cool.
This is the only one
All right, our History
I
Babes
can
Nation.
Find and know of with such a very meta example of mapping to Whoa. Put on an area you don't know, put explorers like Magellan and Cook and another British guy who did the same thing as Sir Francis Drake, and then a Dutch guy, just the set of explorers who sailed around the world, and then Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci on each side. Just all of these funny little portraits.
Well, Columbus shouldn't have even been on there. I mean, he got lost.
He didn't get a map. So,
hilarious.
Columbus and Vespucci didn't get a map. They're just little.
They're like second rate cartographers.
Yeah, just like bookends. Just like, hey, I should throw them in there. There's no like little text.
Like the B team.
Yeah, mm-hmm. just like, oh, I should acknowledge them because mm-hmm. they're people, I guess.
Fine.
But the maps are. That's and Ptolemy gets a map.
Oh.
So that's interesting.
How did you end up on that map? Like, when did you encounter that map and say, like, okay, this has everything that I want to talk about?
This is the map.
That's a good question, too. I was looking at this very dense book about the antipodes, which is the name that they used to give the other part of the world. It just means people with their feet opposite. So just like what's on the other side of the world is what they used to call the Terra Incognita. And I was reading a book about medieval representations of that part of the world. And then when we got near the epilogue of the book, there was just like a quick zoom in picture of this map. The same guys inherited the tradition from another cartographer named Mercator, which I don't know if you guys have talked about Mercator before and his like the problematic.
Yeah, because the Mercator map is
the foundation of like the Eurocentric map. Exactly. And like we still use it improperly and that right? sort of thing. So this yeah. guy named Jodocus Hondius inherited, wow, meaning he went and light. Bought these copper plates from Mercator's uh-huh. estate sale and then carried on the traditions. They were kind of mentioning him and like there was a zoom in of this map and I was like, what the fuck? This is very strange. And so that's piqued my interest. And I was sort of stewing on the idea of ignorance and knowledge. And so rather than the sort of traditional way people had represented the bottom of the world, which is either to put nothing, to fill it with all kinds of other decoration to distract from the fact mm-hmm. that there was nothing, mm-hmm. or fill it with monsters, he right. put signs of knowledge. So very much like these large descriptive cartouches filled with like, this is the math that makes this map work. And these diagrams of everything, mm-hmm. like very much like explicit scientific instructions. He then puts these little tiny bios and little portraits and little maps of these people who had sailed around the world, both successfully and unsuccessfully, because Magellan died. But his whole right. like, boat, yeah, everybody made it, like certain amounts of people on his journey made it around. But I thought it was a really fascinating way to conceptualize the unknown by using very overt forms of knowledge. Mm-hmm. What did that mean? Mm-hmm. And so I sort of thought about that and I sort of interpreted it as Dutch propaganda. This was when the Dutch yes. were doing their thing, yes. sailing yes. everywhere in a very fascinating way because they weren't necessarily trying like the British or the Portuguese to kind right. of just take land or the Spanish to just like get land. They were like, you know what? I'm going to go put a trading post over here mm-hmm. and over here and over here. And it led to a ton of exploration on the part of the Dutch. And so I sort of interpreted this as, hey, look, like look at all these people who made it. And like, look at this really illustrious space. It's very scientific. Somebody else should do it. Someone should fund something like this to kind of continue our power on the world stage. And yeah, this is right before it's made within sort of 50 years before people got to Australia. So this is before they knew what was down that far. And within 100 years before they were like, oh no, there's not this gigantic continent. I guess I didn't mention, like people thought there was just this gigantic continent of like jungle paradise down at the bottom of the world that they could go extract resources from. And there would be these indigenous peoples like there were in other parts of the world. So mm-hmm. they were like, oh, look, we'll go tap that.
Yeah.
And then people kept going and sailing lower and lower and lower. And they were like, you know what? It's real cold down here. And so, yeah, this is like last like couple of decades before they're like, oh, no, we actually know what's down there. So it's the last little flash of propaganda time, I guess.
Honestly, maps are propaganda.
Yeah.
Yes.
Totally. 100%. I know. I wanted to kind of talk about
And I mean, I thought about this when you brought up Mercator and stuff, but how even today, most of our maps that are used in elementary school classrooms, like real maps, are still pretty wrong. Like, we still have issues with scale.
Yes,
and like Africa being smaller than it actually is.
Right. Way too small.
Just to like fit it comfortably in the map.
Yeah, but you can fit the entire world in Africa. Yeah. Basically.
Like almost. And for so long, it's just proportionally made to look like it's what I think it's made to look like smaller than the United States.
The entire southern hemisphere is off.
Yeah.
So everywhere south. And the United States is off to Europe. The way the Mercator projection is, like China is too small. Mm-hmm. The United States is too small. But Europe is weirdly inflated. And part of this is just you have to choose a way to flatten a circle.
Yeah.
And it's going to make things wonky. But Mercator did it that way. And obviously, it's like, if I'm trying to measure distance, I'm going to be doing it based on what I know. And then it just kept going. And so there's all kinds of different things called projections, which is just different versions of how you represent the world. The one that's probably the closest to accurate is called the Gall-Peters projection. They sort of redid it in the 70s. And there's a great West Wing episode as well that talks about like how the projections and the sort of perceptions of how big things are relative to everything else is off. The way we look at it, we think Greenland is like gigantic. That's like my favorite example because people are like, oof, Greenland, it's a lot of land. It takes up a lot of space. If they're actually thinking about maps, which is unlikely. But it's really only, it's like the size of California, you know? So like this space it takes up
That's on the map, so interesting, really off.
Africa is huge. South America is huge. Australia is quite large as well. And so these things that we think are just, meh, it's kind of the same size or slightly smaller than the United States is not accurate.
Accurate. And I noticed too, I was on Google Maps the other day, not too long ago. And I don't even remember, I was looking, oh, I think it's because I'm about to drive across the country. So I was kind of planning that out. And Google Maps has started to do things where it is accurate because it's on the internet, so you don't have to have a completely flat surface. You can have a 3D model, and it kind of blew my mind. And like the fact that when I think about the United States, I think about it as just straight across, but the world is tilted. And you don't think about the fact that, like, if you're looking at a map, you kind of assume that where we are in Northern California is going to just line straight across the United States. But that's not true because the globe is tilted. So where we are in Northern California, like, the United States is at a diagonal. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And, like, it was, like, the first time I was ever, like,
it's like when you're on a plane and you see like how your plane is flying if you go a long distance and you're like, that makes no sense to me. And you're like, oh, but the earth is curved. So if you actually, they're implanting the actual route on a flat map. So it looks,
it's like
real
why
weird.
Why are you going this big part like over the ocean?
Yeah. Like, like, why are we going to Canada on our way to Europe? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah. You think you're on the same horizontal space on the planet as this other city, but you're not at all because everything's tilted. It's just never been represented that way. No. It's just like...
And it's tricky. Like, I'll give poor sweet cartographers around the land are trying to flatten the sphere. You know, globes have it right because it's just right on a sphere, but it can't even fathom trying to figure out the math.
I Googled accurate world maps and it's confusing. Like, all the different ways people can do it, it kind of messes with your mind. So I understand.
There's all kinds of like wonky sort of curvy ones that sort of do scoops and...
Yeah, because you just choose your direction that you're kind of angling from and it all looks completely different. It's like, it takes you a second. Dang.
Yeah, it's crazy because still, even with globes, when I think back to being a kid and looking at globes, I think to make sense of it in your own brain, you kind of correct even.
Yeah.
Like, you tilt with the globe to make sense of it. But by doing that, you're skewing what you're looking at, you know?
Well, there's confusing things. Like, this was a part of cartographic speak in the medieval times, was just like, it's very confusing for your brain to be like, wait, that's upside down from me. How do they stand on it? So that was like, in addition to the earth is burning in the middle and we can't go through, they were like, nobody can live on the bottom, to be sure. Like, you'd fall off. You know, you can't stand upside down if you're if there was land down there, there's no people in it, certainly. And if they are there, they're monsters because, you know, they have some other powers.
I mean, checks out.
And so there's a certain logic to it. And it is confusing when you're a kid. You're looking at a globe. You're like,
oh, yeah.
But like all of that, aren't you? Like, because we're on the upper part and it sort of makes general sense for us, like with science and gravity and what we learn generally. But the bottom of the world is confusing to a European, North American sort of.
Yeah. And it's hard to go down there, you know?
Yeah.
It's out of the way. It's cold.
It's very much out of the way.
It's a lot of ice. It's hard to get there, you know? So how then? I don't want to make, I shouldn't even say this because I feel like we're just going to go off on this crazy tangent, but how can you possibly observe these things and still insist on a flat earth?
Oh,
I just don't think they observe these things, right? Like, do they just like, this is where the ignorance comes in?
Yeah, like, they're like, I don't, you know, it's...
Haven't seen it.
Honestly, my instinct is that because everything we just said, it's kind of more complicated to believe the truth.
Yeah.
And it's like it's... flat earth is a concept that really, when you look at all these things, all these aspects of what makes human life on earth and like mapping of the earth difficult, it's easier to digest the idea of, no, it's just flat and there mm-hmm. are boundaries because that's the dimension we live in.
Yeah.
I think it kind of is easier to make sense of that. And that's why people believe it. And that's why people believe a lot of conspiracy theories is because they are easy answers for complicated questions.
That's a lot. It's Occam's razor. Like yeah. The easiest answer is the simplest one.
100%.
Sometimes, though, that can go, if you just get in a boat and sail around the world, you'll eventually get back to where you came from. So, like, that's real easy.
But, yeah, I get the,
you
like,
hope that that's what happens.
That's true. It doesn't always happen.
Yeah, so I can imagine that spending a good deal of time studying maps, you had to have come across some real wild fringe theories about what the world is like and whether or not we know where everything is now. Do you think we know where everything is now?
No.
Okay.
No. For the most part, it's advanced a ton. Satellites help. I mean, being creepy and spying. Just generally, though, there's lots of great, wonderful weather and science satellites doing things. You can really get a sense of where stuff is, though there's lots of stuff we still don't know about where it might be located, what it is, how to map it. Things are shifting generally.
Where my mind went was the ocean.
Yeah, yes. The ocean's really tricky. So
the ocean we know like
so
nothing about.
Uncharted.
And like deepest of jungle, people are still like, I don't know what's over there.
There's monsters down there.
I mean,
let me tell you that
you've seen the deep sea planet Earth, it kind of
right.
Oh gosh.
I love watching that shit.
Me too. I love deep ocean fish. Mm-hmm. They're so weird and crazy and I love it so much. Yeah. But yeah, we know so little about the ocean. It's like a completely different world almost.
Yeah, and then like what do we count as a map and what do we count as what we know and don't know? You know, do we know where every like human settlement is? No.
There's actually a really good episode of Stuff You Should Know about, are there people that are truly off the grid? Like, are there unaccounted for people? And there are. There's not a lot of them.
Were they talking about like laser scanning and LIDAR?
Yeah. There are. I mean, there's not a lot, but there are pockets of what appears to be, according to like heat radar and stuff, known undocumented people.
Where?
I don't remember.
Mostly the Amazon.
Yeah, probably the Amazon, but
mostly the Amazon.
You will all have to listen to that episode because I don't remember the details.
Do they think that there's people there because there's like heat?
They're doing this thing, and I don't know the science that well behind it, but it's just very useful for all kinds of other sites in the world. They're doing this thing called LIDAR, which is an acronym for something with lasers. So they're flying over these places and scanning, mostly in the jungle, because it's really difficult to see what's underneath all the vegetation. And the lasers can kind of get through all the organic material and see what the land is actually doing, what kind of structures there might be that are more solid than just piles of leaves and brush and sort of just tree gunk. And so they're seeing these things that they're like, well, that looks like a really perfect square and another perfect square and other
like
things.
Like a settlement of
some sort. Like, yeah. So they're seeing things that resemble forms made by humans. You know, there'll be like a levee or some sort of berm or things like that. And they're using it a ton in ruins in the Yucatan and in Honduras and Guatemala to sort of see how big sites like Tikal or somewhere like that would have been at their actual peak, because like what you can actually see in the jungle is so small because the jungle is intense. And so looking at that, that's how they're kind of investigating other parts of the world to see what's going on.
I wonder, we talked about this at some point on some episode and it was on a TED Radio Hour podcast, and there was an archaeologist who was using, I think it was laser and satellite imagery to uncover all of these, mostly in Egypt, but she also did some in Rome, just finding all these vast amounts of different build-up layers of different civilizations and different structures, and it was all done without actually digging into the ground.
Yes.
Space archaeology.
Yeah. Which is really interesting too, because especially in terms of thinking about maps, is how they're such temporal constructs, where how do you convey that when the main thing is like making a map of what is currently built, but there's so many layers, and then just with the natural progression of the world where things get covered up and then they get uncovered. You know, I've seen maps that try and combine, like I have a map of Rome where it's like past and present, and it's a weird map because it has current streets and structures in Rome with then these sort of ghost shadow structures there too, and that's their way of trying to show the crossover between the two, which is visually interesting, but it's also like you have to pick and choose because you can't do it all visually.
Yeah,
maps across that could get very many, intense.
Yes,
many a century.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just
The laser thing is interesting in mapping. It's super fascinating. Like there's a babysit a sweet, sweet little gem of a child sometimes, and he's very into documentaries of all sorts. And so we recently watched one about them laser scanning Egyptian pyramids to figure out how are they constructed, like where are the passages, so you don't have to dig into these things. You can see where the cavities are inside and where things are without having to actually do it. And it's really interesting. And it's it really
helps.
Non-invasive
surgery.
Yeah, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they've been doing it in Xi'an with the terracotta warriors. They haven't excavated where the actual emperor is buried for a multiplicity of reasons. So I think they've been stewing and or starting laser scanning to be like, what's in there?
That's awesome. You know, I think that the overall level of curses is going to go down, you know, because now we don't actually have to bust in there, you know.
Keep curses to a minimum.
Yeah. All those cursed early 20th century archaeologists.
So many of them.
Damn it. If only we had lasers.
Lasers so I could see inside.
Oh, that's good.
They're saying this from their never ending hell.
Yeah.
Their restless, eternal slumber. It's still spooky season as we record.
We're still feeling spooky. Let's take another quick break and then maybe come back and look at some contemporary artists that are playing with maps and cartography and stuff like that. We'll be right back.
Bye.
We're back.
Hello.
Hi.
And we're going to look at some fun examples of ways that contemporary artists are either engaging with cartography or commenting on cartography or making cool, fun things that are in relation to maps. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. I know so little about things after 1800.
Right.
So.
Same.
Wait, are there more maps? Like, no. Did people keep making material?
No. It couldn't be.
Is it not on my phone? Like, wait.
All right, so these are fun. Some examples of minimalist metropolitan maps, like maps of cities and bus systems and things like this.
A tube map?
Yeah.
Ooh.
And then just turning it into a minimalist representation of these colors and lines.
Yep. Yeah.
It's cool, right?
It's beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's love the color coding. Just naturally, that appeals to my to my eye.
I'm like, oh, I'll just take the purple one.
Yeah, like have you guys seen that map I have? I mean, it's from the early 20th century London, where they started color coding London based on wealth.
Yeah.
So black is the poorest of the poor color, and then the richest of the rich is like a really deep red. And they're really beautiful maps. Like, you just have this whole array because they started doing surveys and color coding it just for their records.
That's interesting. A heavy way to start dividing and color coding people.
Yeah.
It's true. They do it later in the States in a really awful, horrifying way of just like, oh, look, that's where other people are. We can bulldoze that part of town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sacramento did it. It's icky.
Oh.
It's no good.
Anyway, but pretty lines.
Yeah.
Back to the pretty lines.
These are
like
cool.
The happiest arteries in the whole world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. Oh, that's a nice one.
Mm.
Yeah, they're kind of like, I don't know, abstract feeling. They're very...
That's really fun because it's like without any of the words, this is just...
Yeah.
It's like you take the metro map and remove all of the actual information, so it's just the lines.
Exactly.
And that's really interesting to perceive how people move about a space.
Definitely.
Just
because it's the
humans.
It's the bare bones of it. It's the bare bones of the system that humans created.
It's almost like migration trails.
Yeah.
City migration trails.
Pilgrimage routes, perhaps.
Oh, yes. Yeah, very interesting. We'll obviously put some images up on our website if you guys want to see these as well. These are by Peter Dovak.
did these.
I'm looking at this same article. There's many different artists here that are featured. If you scroll all the way down, it's a map of the world made up of matchsticks. And over it, it says, everything is ending. And then they set it on fire.
Ooh.
That's pretty cool.
That was Javier.
Oh, wow.
Habalera.
Climate change thing to very darkly.
Yeah.
That looks like a Mercator projection.
It's still, yep, exactly.
That, definitely. It's your classic map. Yeah. So there, a little bit of a performance aspect here. Performance meets map, which is very interesting.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Did any of you have a map painted on the asphalt at your elementary school?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also could be performance meets map.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, can we talk for a second about, this is something that has always interested me. People who like tattoo maps on their bodies and then will fill in when they've been places.
I've seen that. Yes.
Yeah, that's a thing.
People like tattoo coordinates of important life events, which is,
or just states. A lot of times people get states on their body. That's a big one. But I've definitely seen it done a few times, getting a whole, basically like a Mercator projection map on your back and filling in when you go places.
Very strange.
I have a question. Is there a map that you do endorse?
I endorse them all as an art object, you know, okay. In terms of like, it's just too tricky.
Like, what about like as political objects, you know?
That's a good question. In terms of
just how, so we know that the Mercator map is Eurocentric and just altogether not accurate, right?
Yeah, it's accurate in certain capacities,
right.
But not in other ones. I would say in terms of like, how do you perceive in terms of just like, hey, do I understand what the sizes of everything are? The Peters projection is good just because it gives you a sense, although it's like everything is squished. Like it's still jarring to the eye and you couldn't navigate with it. I don't even know if I would ever, even endorse a map just because they're so particular as to what you're doing. And I love that about them.
It's the idea that really like these objects, they're built as though they're objective, are never objective,
ever.
They're
so you make
always
them
subjective.
What you want them to be. Like I love, this is a plug for something that I presume your listeners would like, that New York Times, I'm a subscriber to the online stuff, and their map game, their graphic game is out of control. It's so good.
They are great.
Oh, yeah. They're just doing great stuff. And so I don't even care about the projection. It's like, okay, like what are the demographics of like, they have every precinct from the 2016 election mapped out. Like,
yeah.
Who voted in what way. And just these really interactive things. They've just mapped like every building.
Yeah. New York Times is just phenomenal. Corey and I TA'd a information design class in grad school, and we definitely,
you would have been really into that, Maria.
Loved, yeah. The professor was a fan of New York Times infographics.
Their infographics are just so good.
Yeah.
So
it's
good.
It's worth the subscription. It makes me so excited.
Yeah. And it is. It's just an interesting intersection of design, you know, aesthetics, what's going to grab people's eye, but how can we convey information in the most straightforward way as possible, you know? And I think when you look at things like maps, yeah, there's this whole spectrum of, you have people who really took that challenge seriously in terms of what they're trying to portray to people, and then other people that, you know, is more of like, I'm just gonna do what feels good to me, you know?
Yeah, which is fine. Or yeah, in terms of conveying information, like National Geographic obviously does all kinds of maps, and they're trying their best, and it just really depends on what information you're trying to convey, and it's always going to be fucked up in some manner. Like, you're always gonna be excluding something.
Well, it's like the idea, there is this meme a long time ago that I loved, and it was stills taken from Scooby-Doo, the Scooby-Doo cartoons. It was one of the scenes where they're unmasking, you know, the bad guy or whatever. You know how they're always like, it turns out it was this person all along, and the meme was, it turns out that objectivity was just subjectivity all along. And that like spoke to my soul, because I feel like all throughout academia and the humanities and like whatever trail you go down, the idea that anyone can put out information that isn't in some way colored by their own subjective thoughts and experiences is false.
It's absurd. Yeah.
It's just not real. You know, like, you can try your damnedest, but you're going to pay attention to the things that your brain has been programmed to pay attention to. Everything is kind of biased in some way, you know?
Well, and with, you can't know everything about all the things.
Exactly.
Like this gets into my like ignorance research of just like, every sentence you say does not reflect all of the knowledge of the whole world. So just inherently in human thought. thought. Like, mm-hmm. you're not going to cover everything every time. There's an absurdist story for maps related to Lewis Carroll talking about, like, oh, the best map is one that just covers your house and is to scale of the whole world. And that's the only way you're going to be true to reality is, right. like, actual reality. And you can't make a map of that because that's just silly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting thing to stew on.
It is. Yeah, there's a lot of layers to it.
No, but otherwise, they can just be pretty things covered in pretty things,
right.
or useful ways to convey information.
Yes,
or just weird things when you're like, oh, look, they only have three continents, and one of them is covered in people with a foot umbrella on top of their head, or you know, that sort of thing.
Totally,
so, you know.
I mean, I think that's another, and you kind of talked about it with your research too. So, like, already the representation, what maps are trying to depict. But then you have this whole nother layer of when you look at maps that incorporate other illustrational ideas, like trying to, going back to like the monster idea, mm-hmm. or like once you start adding on these layers, as opposed to this is just a place, adding on these layers of characters or of illustrations of what a place might look like, it becomes kind of like a storybook narrative, you know? Mm-hmm. It becomes a very fictionalized type thing, which is really cool in some ways, but yeah.
Yeah, I like to think of them as art objects,
yeah,
and not mm-hmm. as this yeah. scientific data that has no point of view.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
And so, I think yeah. it's also important to recognize that scientific data can have a point of view.
Yeah.
Like, we want to think it doesn't, but it does. Mm-hmm. Like, and yeah, and maps, I think, are a great place where all that kind of collides, mm-hmm. you know. This one is just kind of fun. I'll just throw this one out because it's fun for art historians. It is a Klimt-inspired map of Manhattan.
Ooh. Whoa.
I'll show you guys.
Whoa.
Oh.
Ooh, shiny.
Oh.
That's really cool.
Huh. Huh.
That's nice.
I like so the- I think that's a very clear example of an art object.
Yeah. And I think people are comfortable with that
yeah,
idea now.
Yeah. That's playing with being a map at mm-hmm. the same time, but it's clearly like it's decorative. Mm-hmm. It's an aesthetic mm-hmm. art object that mm-hmm. is also mapping out a space.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think people are comfortable with that sort of thing. It's like when you go to Disneyland or something, your map isn't like perfectly to scale. It's got like cartoonish versions yeah. of things. So you know
right.
where it is. You're
right.
like, oh, well,
right.
that's a way for me to get there, but I don't need it to be perfectly accurate.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. Mm-hmm. Do we have any other thoughts? I mean, I think we dealt with some big theoretical concepts
yes.
on the nature of knowledge and knowing.
I like that you made that point that just because something is considered scientific doesn't make it entirely devoid of any like subjective mm-hmm. bias. Mm-hmm. That's what I hope people will take away from this episode is yeah. that maps are not objective. They're really yeah. not.
They're just really not. I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting things to kind of parse through in thinking about the way we use our immediate environments to make art objects, mm-hmm. the way we think about what is considered objective knowledge, the way we think about places and spaces that we're unfamiliar with.
Mm-hmm. Like,
all of that intersects with maps.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them cool and interesting. Maps.
Yay.
Maps. Check them out.
Check them out. Also, on our Patreon, we'll have a patron discussion forum section. So all of you patrons, if you want to parse through some of these.
Some map chat.
Yeah, map chat.
Ooh, yeah.
If you want to have some map chat, we'll have a discussion thread up for you guys to kind of share what you're thinking about this stuff. We'd love to hear it. Listener mail.
Yep, got it right here.
Let's do it.
All right, subject line, Heart Vinny. Dear babes, thank you for your great work. Just listening to your Vinny Van Gogh episode. I love his artwork, but most of all, Vinny himself. This year, I was able to go to Amsterdam and visit the Van Gogh Museum. Also, in Melbourne, Australia last year, we have had a Van Gogh winter exhibition. 2018 was MoMA, which I loved again. During the Melbourne winter exhibition, the audio was based on an actor reading the letters of Van Gogh relating to the exhibited artwork, which added a lot to the experience. People only see him as somewhat an eccentric artist, but as you have said, he is just pure. Thank you for noting the fact that it is not the mental illness which solely made Van Gogh. He did suffer mental illness, but he was aware of his health and he was actually trying to get better. His struggle with mental illness has struck me and helped me along my journey too. I am suffering from mental illness and there is always stigma towards medication, treatment, and awareness. However, throughout my journey, I have learned that life does not need to be hard in experience. and I don't need to experience constant unhappiness. It is easier to have more happy moments. And I've learned the easier way is not always about being lazy or taking a shortcut. It is simply about being wiser. No pain, no gain. Fuck that. You might gain something, but it still hurts, and why avoid unnecessary pain? Vinny has inspired me in many ways, and I am now super proud that I can confidently say life is beautiful. I fell in love with your podcast when I saw Fuck Gauguin on your podcast episode list, and this was my debut episode of The Art History Babes. I finally got on Patreon, not much, but I hope it will be of some contribution to your great work. Thank you so much. This is so sweet. With my heritage being Japanese, if you ever have a chance, it would be great if you could have a chat about the daughter of Hokusai. Her work is very different from her dad, but is just as amazing. She was an independent woman with guts and love for art, just like Hokusai. Also, if you ever have a chance to come down under, we have great galleries in Australia too, including many local and international artworks. All the best, girls, and I look forward to hearing many more episodes. Yumi.
Ginny is wearing a Hokusai t-shirt right now.
I am. She is. I didn't even realize that.
Subtle.
Thank you.
That would be dope to talk about his daughter.
Yeah, I know. I really liked that idea. Yeah.
Let's do it. We should make that happen.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for writing in and sharing your experiences. We love hearing how the stuff we make affects people in different ways. It is very important to us, and we just thank you for sharing those things and supporting us in any way. We love you.
Yeah, and we're glad you enjoyed the Vinny Mango episode so much. We really enjoyed making it, so it's good to hear.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Thanks for hanging out with us today, you guys.
Yeah, thanks so much. Check out all of our other stuff, all of our other content. Check out our YouTube for sure. If you like the Art History Babes and you like what we're doing, consider our Patreon, patreon.com/arthistorybabes, to help us to keep making the content.
Yeah.
Every little bit helps.
It does. We're out here hustling, so we really appreciate literally every single patron so much, and every single listener. You guys are great, and you're fantastic and supportive and awesome. Follow us on all the social medias.
Yeah, thank you, Mariah, for being with
us
today and talking to us about maps, something that we didn't consider before as even an episode that we would do. So this is really cool. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks for having me. Same.
You all are a joy.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the Art History Babes.
Like my, my... I'm starting over.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.